accession number 9378, reel 3.
Vice Marshal Bennett, reel 3.
They argued that the best crews were too valuable and that putting them out in front to lead the rest, which might be a very good idea, would also expose them to greater risk, and the losses amongst your best cruisers would be so high that it would be prohibitive. In other words, you'd lead all the force with a good bunch of people in front, but not for long, because the leaders would be shot down and lost. That was one of the things. And of course the other one was that the training of these people had to be good, and you would weaken the squadrons of the main force if you took them away. And that was a very valid one. Taking the very best crews away from the squadrons was the most unpopular thing I ever did. Naturally, they all looked to their squadron commander, and to have their squadron commander whisked away down to headquarters Pathfinder force to become a leader of the rest may have been a great honour to the person concerned, but it was a tremendous loss to the squadron. And that was their argument.
So how was the opposition overcome?
Well, by adopting tactics that countered this. The tactics were very simple. First of all, you didn't just take, say, half a dozen very top crews and put them in out in front of the rest 5 minutes beforehand. You put, by all means you did that, but you also put 25 supporting aircraft in 10 minutes beforehand, or whatever it was you decided. In other words, you took the brunt of the first opposition with the help of supporters, and the supporters were mixed with the the markers, and therefore relieved the load of flak that would otherwise come onto these individual aircraft. By doing that, we kept the losses of markers almost to normal proportions. In fact, they were slightly better, because they were better crews anyway, and they didn't suffer these tremendous losses. Now, that was always in the back of my mind. It was always part of my plans. And, of course, we also did other things like diversionary raids. We didn't just go and mark the target itself. We'd probably already marked another target, and that took the fighters away. We, in fact, adopted some sensible tactical manoeuvres, and the result was that the losses of Pathfinders overall for the whole war were no worse, in fact, slightly less than the main force. You had to have an element of surprise to do that. The great exception, when we did really suffer, was during the Battle of Berlin, which was a scandalous thing. That was a Churchillian doing. They told the Hun we were coming to Berlin every night without exception. And, of course, we had the most terrible time because we could not adopt any tactical surprise. And if you don't have tactical surprise, you get hacked down. Simple as that. But anyway, early on, we were fortunate in being able to change things and do things. And, of course, we also did things like playing with colours. The pyrotechnics that we had were wonderful, made by the fireworks industry of Great Britain. Colours, green, red, blue, purple, yellow, white, cascading with delays, without delays, varying heights and varying levels and so on. And we could ring the changes. We could start with a colour that would make the Hun think that's where we were going, and then go somewhere else. Things like that. We could change our aiming points and so on. So we overcame that difficulty. Training was more difficult because you couldn't get all the good crews you wanted, and therefore you had to do a certain amount of training. And also you had to prove their worth, their merit. You couldn't ask them to lead until you were confident. So we did a lot of experimental work with photography. Howard Lees was our group a photographic officer, and he did a lot of new work, things like photo flashes that were different and with and without delays. Anyway, between a lot of all these innovations and changes, we managed to keep our losses down and our results up. We did have failures occasionally, for example, the first night. Bert Harris called force warrants together on the first night and required them to operate that same night with no training, no direction, no help of any sort. That was typical of Bert Harris. He meant well, it was to show determination, but of course the practical result was just silly.
You've mentioned that the opposition you had from Pierce and Harris, but who was it who took your side?
Oh, most all the eminent three, including the chief of the air staff, Portal. He came to the conclusion that we must try this method, and he supported me. But on top of that, there were people like Baker. Baker was ACS Ops. He was a great supporter. And all the so-called three musketeers, that's three wing commanders, in DB Ops, were very much on my side. And that included later, not to start with, but later it included Sid Bufton, who was very unpopular with Harris because of that. But he was doing his best to support us, and so on. And we, in the command, we had the Canadian AOC and this man I mentioned, Roddy Carr. He was a wonderful supporter. And the three group, we had one outright knife you in the back antagonist, a very nice chap, but nevertheless the worst enemy we could have had, called Cochrane, who knew nothing at all about flying or navigation or technical matters, but was out to get Pathfinder Force, largely, I think, to please the CNC. He knew the CNC was opposed to the idea. He knew the CNC would not himself do anything, shall we say, dirty, and therefore Cochrane did things like instructing his squadron commanders to report instantly to him any mistakes made by Pathfinders. Well, the normal channels would have been quite adequate, but he wanted to get his knife in us and would do everything he could to stop us. And it was very successful. He almost ruined the Pathfinder Force with his dirty tricks, as they now call them. Anyway, that's later on. Where did we get to? We should mention at this stage the wonderful work of the Boffins. They were moved up to Great Malvern under a man called Dr. Rowe, a civil servant scientist, who had the most difficult job of trying to make these very temperamental scientists all work together to our benefit. They were given an airfield at Defford, close to Great Malvern, and when I went down there to start work on them, the station commander would only work from 9 till 4. He would not allow night flying. He would not allow almost anything that I wanted. But the Boffins themselves were excellent. The first team I worked with was Philip D. There were four of them, Philip D. and Lovell, who's now at the telescope, and two or three others, and they told me that they could get a reflection from the ground that would differentiate between land and water and between built-up area and plain ground, and that they could do this in, not more than about 10 years. So I burst a blood vessel and did a bit of shouting and said, "We'll do it immediately. We won't take 10 years. We won't take 10 days. Now, let's get cracking." And they said, "All right, well, we'll start work immediately next week." I said, "No, you won't. You'll start work now." We went out and got into the airplane and went flying straight away with Dr. O'Kane as the Boffin in charge. And he flew with me by day and night, and we had a vision of the ground within a couple of days, and we were operational within a month. Wonderful effort. Philip D was undoubtedly the greatest brain, but there was a, you know, a really wonderful team of people. In addition to O'Kane, whom I mentioned, there's Lovell. Some of them, EMI people, as they called it, the Gramophone Company in those days, and they produced H2S, which meant that we could paint a map of the ground below us from 20,000 feet through cloud, which had never been dreamt of before. And although it's commonplace now, in those days it was far from commonplace.
What was H2S?
H2S was started off with a 10-centimeter pulse transmitter, using a... Well, it started off using a klystron, and that wasn't powerful enough, but we heard that the magnetron was coming along, and we used a magnetron, and that was enough power to get a reflection. You see, it was a very, very high-powered pulse. It wasn't continuous transmission. It didn't dissipate its energy on continuous wave. It was a very, very short pulse. I can't remember. It was about 0.5 of a microsecond, I think. Anyway, whatever it was, it did give you this reflection, and we presented the returning signal on a cathode ray tube, which I had some experience of, to their surprise, by the way, because they hadn't themselves had any, whereas I had, thanks to the Durban University people, I had some experience of it. Anyway, that was one team. And the other team was OBO, which was limited in range. It was a responder system, not a reflector, a responder, in which they sent out, again, a high-powered pulse and a delay of known duration and the return signal. And you measured the distance by that method. We could hold an aircraft within 65 feet of a position from here in England. We could hold the aircraft over the Ruhr to that sort of accuracy. Now, that was, the head man was a man called Reeves of Standard Telephone, and the deputy was F.E. Jones, Dr. F.E. Jones. He played tennis with me here yesterday. Anyway, F.E. Jones was the deputy head, but the two of them between them actually made the sets themselves on breadboards. We didn't go to industry at all. We made them all in Pathfinders.
What do you mean by breadboards?
That's just a lash-up, you know. Rough wiring system, we used to call them breadboards. In other words, you screwed things to a board or soldered them and so on. I'd have thought that's a terminology you would have gone on forever. It was so explicit. Anyway, with the breadboards and oboe, we... although we started first with H2S, that was the reflector system, we were not satisfied with it, and we did everything we could to improve it. We went to 3 centimeters instead of 10 and things like that. But the oboe development was quite different, unconnected, and quite independent of each other. Now, we did some tests, first of all, with Wellingtons, with a pressurized cabin, the cabin being a ship's boiler, which we put into the fuselage of a Wellington. I burst my eardrums with it. I was deaf for a fortnight or so. But it was, we could prove that it was doing, and of course we were not allowed to drop bombs blind, which we did, and got excellent results. But the height of this Wellington was not nearly adequate, so we did some other experiments, and the CO of the squadron, 109 squadron as it was, there was a man called McMullen, an Australian, who said, the people down at Hatfield have got a very fine new aeroplane. I don't know anything about it, but I've heard good things. You better get onto it. So we rang up the people down at Hatfield, and they came straight up to lunch. Bishop was the chief designer, and he brought his number one man with him. They had lunch with me, and they told me the performance and the height. They could get to 28,000 feet even with the first Mosquito at very high speed. No guns, no ammunition, no bombs, just mosquito. Would that do? And I said, yes, that'll do. So I went down to Hatfield myself the next day, and we borrowed a mosquito. I took it back to Witten and did some tests, day and night, and at maximum heights. And we were dropping blind from 28,000 feet with wonderful results. The error was only the error of the bomb fall. In other words, it was better than any other form of sighting device. And so I demanded it. I was immediately told that it wouldn't work and all this sort of thing. And anyway, they didn't have capacity, and if you did have capacity, you couldn't get it in a mosquito, which was too small, and so on. Every excuse under the sun. But we had a formal meeting at the Air Ministry when all these problems were trotted out, and I counted them in every case. Things like, well, you couldn't possibly handle it with one navigator. And I said, well, we've been doing all these test flying with one navigator, and the navigator navigating on his knee, and all the gubbins, the boxes, down in the nose. And they accepted that, and then they trotted out all sorts of other difficulties. And finally they said, well, in any case, it's all academic. You can't fly a mosquito at night. And I said, why not? The exhaust flames are so bad they are blinding. You cannot land a mosquito at night. To which I replied, I'm very sorry, but if I'd only known, I would never have done it as I have for the last 6 or 8 days every night. And they swallowed that one, and so we got the mosquito. And that really was the making of Obo, because it didn't have enough height or speed otherwise. But by going up to 28,000 feet, it was optical range, you see. And so we were able to cover the whole of the Ruhr from this country. We had Walmer Castle and Trimmingham and so on. It was immediately done. We had no difficulty at all. And the willingness of everybody, and the fact that we made the equipment ourselves on our own, in our own workshops, made it easier to do, because we didn't depend on somebody else. As I say, the deputy head of that team was here yesterday. He's still alive and well. And the deputy head of H2S also, of course, is alive and well, Dr. Lovell, Sir Bernard Lovell. But the boffins really, the Pathfinders without boffins would have been an improvement, a big improvement, but they would not have been half as good as they were with the boffins.
What about Harris? Did you get to know him very well?
Well, I always had known him fairly well, because I'd served under him in Pembroke Dock. And of course, during the bomber business, so long as I was commanding Pathfinders, with his blessing, but with his open opposition to the idea, but with his personal blessing, he was always very fair to me. Not always, I wouldn't quite say that. I mean, you can hardly say that taking squadrons away from the Pathfinders was fair. Anyway, he did his best to be fair to me, and we got along personally perfectly well, but not always in agreement. He would be the first, incidentally, to agree with what I'm saying. He wouldn't resent it. He was a big enough man to... I've criticised him publicly in front of his face, both during the war and after, and he's always taken it with very good grace. And his... You know, his wife is still around. She would confirm that. But he was a funny mixture. Mentioning his wife, his widow, reminds me of a story about... 2 years ago, or 3 years ago, she rang me up and told me that he was an air marshal by that time, I think, Corryton, C-O-R-Y-T-O-N, Corryton, who had been the CO of 5 Group, had died. And I said to her, oh, that's a pity, he was the best of all the main force group commanders. And she said, yes, Bunny agrees with you, he thinks so too. Bunny is Bert Harris. Now, to give you some idea of the man, he sacked Corryton in a moment of temper and never reinstated him. The stacking was something that came into my purview with the simple reason that it was referred to me. He rang me up one day and he said, we can't operate tonight, the weather's a bit dicey and the basis may not be too good, so I'm planning something unusual. I said, oh yes, what is it? He said, I want to send 12 Lancasters from 3 Group and 12 Lancasters from 5 Group to Berlin, unaccompanied, no pathfinders, nothing like that, just on their own. They might sneak through and get away with it. What do you think? And I said, you'll lose 24 aircraft. He said, oh, don't be silly, of course I wouldn't. And I said, of course you would. If you send unsupported small numbers, they'll be picked off one after another, all the way there and all the way back, and you certainly won't get away with it. He said, oh, that's what Corydon thinks, but Cochrane doesn't, and I'm sending them. He put the phone down. Later in the day, I found that Corydon had refused, Cochrane had said, yes, well, I'll send them, and that is why Corydon was sacked and Cochrane was moved over from 3 Group to 5 Group, which was the best group, and that was that. And he never reinstated him, and Corydon was by far the best. I mean, he operated himself, for example, which no other group commanders ever did. Things like that. So,
did you personally like Harris?
I liked him as a person, but not professionally, beyond the fact that he was press on. I did admire his... He would not be stopped by politicians, and generally speaking, he was a very press-on type. But he made some awful criminal mistakes. The Nuremberg one, of course, you'll know about, where we lost 97 aircraft simply because he sent them out to be lost. I told him beforehand, so did everybody else tell him beforehand. He wouldn't cancel. That was his biggest clanger. But he dropped a lot of clangers one way or another. But he was the best person that Bomber Command could have had. Nobody else of that age group or age level, call it what you like, could have done any better operationally, except perhaps Corydon, or, well, there are one or two I could pick on, Tedder, for example. But basically, there was nobody with the press-on spirit of Bert Harris. He stood up for us against the politicians and all the niggling and so on, and when people wanted to say, stop all bombing, killing women and children, how terrible, he was able to get up and say, yes, and what did the Huns do to our women and children? You know, he had an answer all the time. And generally speaking, put them back in their boxes. Not as effectively as I would like to have seen, but it was better than nothing. So. As the result of bringing in mosquitoes to carry Oboe, and incidentally we formed 2 squadrons of mosquitoes for that purpose, and indeed increased it to 3 in effect by having extra strength squadrons, they did the Oboe job, but that meant that I was the happy recipient of all Oboe production bomber version, Mark 4, Mark 9 and Mark 32. They were produced as bombers, and so I, because I was operating mosquitoes, was given the rest of them, and I formed 14 squadrons of them. They were wonderful. They could outpace the German fighters, they could go anywhere in Germany, and I had them modified so that we could, instead of carrying 400 or 500 pound bombs, which incidentally was about the same as we started the war with, without any trouble at all, we managed to, instead of the 500 pounders, to put in 1 4,000 pounder Rockbuster, the biggest bomb then known, and a Mosquito could carry that to Berlin. And the Mosquito raids on Berlin, which always presented as being nuisance raids, were anything but a nuisance. They were major raids. I would send 100 aircraft, for example, in one wave, each dropping 2 tons. That's a lot of bombs, more than Germany dropped on us. And that was just a nuisance raid by my Mosquito force. In fact, once I even sent 2 waves of 100 in one night. But on top of that, they could also do a very useful purpose connected with the Pathfinder marking. If we were going to a target as a main target with Bomber Command as a whole, in order to put the fighters off and to divert any other opposition that might be cropping up, we would send the Mosquitoes to some target through the bomber stream overhead, of course, onto a target to one side or the other. And they would bomb that target with blockbusters and with markers, the main force having been told to ignore it. The bombers would go on their way, the Mosquitoes would come back to England, bombers would turn left onto their proper main target, where the markers had already marked the correct target. And that, by doing that, Mosquitoes took the fighters away from the mainstream and saved hundreds of lives. It was a wonderful contribution. And in the meantime, they weren't wasting their bombers, because they were all bombers, except for a few dummy markers on the other target. And, of course, even the few bombers on the other target were damaging as well as diverting. They weren't just diverting the fighters, they were also damaging the target concerned. And really, it was quite remarkable that people never really realized the contribution made by the Mosquito force. In fact, it was the Mosquito was undoubtedly the most cost-effective thing in the war. It was wonderful. They also, of course, helped to... before we finish the main bomber stream, I would like to make the point that the heavy bombers, anything up to 1,200 at a time, each carrying around about 20,000 pounds, or 12,000 pounds, or 16,000 pounds, they were doing enormous damage, but they were never allowed to continue the strategic bombing of Germany for which they were designed and created. Always they were diverted. Only less than 50% of it was directed at Germany. The rest of it was on buzz bombs or invasion or some diversion. All of it very effective in winning the war, but not in depriving the enemy of the will to fight as much as it would have happened had we had the whole weight of Bomber Command on strategic bombing. I mean, it worked out all right, it doesn't matter, but people say, oh, well, the German bombing wasn't all that effective, was it? The answer is no, when you come to have to bomb the Scharnhorst and Eisenhower in Brest Harbour instead of going to Berlin. In fact, that was such a farce that one of the German admirals made a signal to Berlin saying the bombing of the this was to the admiral, the bombing of the Scharnhorst and Eisenhower in Brest Harbour is the best air raid precaution Berlin has ever had. In other words, we couldn't go to both places, and that sort of thing. So it's a thing to understand. And of course, on top of that, when we had to do naval targets, the famous raid which all the do-goody boys are complaining about at Dresden.